Austin.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Same-sex marriage is back in the headlines this week. In Arkansas, gay and lesbian couples are lining up for marriage licenses after a state judge struck down its ban. Today in Virginia, a federal appeals court is hearing a challenge to the Commonwealth's ban on same-sex marriage. But these are just two of many cases winding through the courts across the country. We wanted to get a breakdown of where these cases are and where they might be going next. So we've called Andrew Harris. He is a legal reporter for Bloomberg News. He's with us from his office in Chicago. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be on the show, Michelle. Thank you.
Also joining us in our Washington, D.C. studios is David Savage. He is the Supreme Court reporter for the L.A. Times, and we're going to talk about that side of the story. David, welcome back to you. Thank you for coming.
Hi, Michelle.
So, Andrew, let me start with you, and let's start with the news in Arkansas. As somebody who's been covering a lot of these cases, how significant is this ruling, especially in a state that's considered the Bible Belt?
Well, Arkansas is unusual. It's one of the first southern states to actually go in that direction. It was a state court judge's ruling as opposed to most of these other rulings that are federal court rulings, but it becomes part of the larger mosaic as we are continually seeing courts across the United States rule in favor of gay marriage proponents as these challenges come before them.
And the attorney general there, as I understand it, plans to appeal the ruling. On what grounds?
Well, that is the law of the state. Attorneys general are typically responsible for upholding the state's laws. This attorney general has said publicly that while he personally is in favor of a right to gay marriage, he's also in favor of defending the laws of the state. So he is carrying out his constitutional duty as a state officer by pursuing this appeal.
And one of the interesting things about the Virginia case, Andrew, is that the scenario is switched there, isn't it? The new attorney general there is declining to defend the state's statute, correct?
Mm-hmm. That is correct, but it did not leave the law without defense. There are two Virginia court clerks who are charged with the statutory duty of dispensing marriage licenses, and they are represented by counsel at the federal appeals court, who are fighting for reversal of Judge Allen's ruling earlier this year that threw out Virginia's ban.
So, David, let's turn to you. A number of other states are also seeing same-sex marriage cases. What are some of the big ones that might end up in front of the Supreme Court?
I think the case that most people have watched is the one from Utah, because a very conservative state, a federal judge there struck down its ban on gay marriage. The state of Utah very much wants to defend that, and is, which I think is important. The Supreme Court's going to want to have a case where there's a strong argument on both sides, and Utah's going to defend its law. It was
When you say a strong argument, you mean a strong legal argument or strong advocates where people will perceive, the public will perceive it as a fair and a vigorous contest?
It's more the latter. Mm-hmm. That is, you remember the California case washed out in June because the state of California was no longer going to argue for its ban on same-sex marriage, and the Supreme Court basically said, you don't have a case. This case is not a real case. So I think the case that's going to finally decide this in the Supreme Court, there needs to be a good argument on both sides. So Utah is going to defend its ban on same-sex marriage. That case was heard in the Tenth Circuit in Denver about a month ago, and so it's on a slightly faster track than the Virginia case. So that's the one that most people have been watching for.
What are the facts in those cases? Are the facts essentially the same, David, in all of these cases? There are individuals with longstanding relationships.
Yes.
Who attractive plaintiffs, basically, who have longstanding relationships, and I think most cases are raising children, who are making the argument that is, and what do these cases all hinge upon? I mean, I think in one of the cases, it hinges upon the argument of what's best for the children. Is it? Is that pretty much the norm? Yeah.
That is the norm in most of these cases. And I think the point you raise is a really interesting one, is because I think what's really changed this debate over the last 10 or 12 years is so many couples coming forward who've been very long committed couples in a very long-term relationship, and many of them having children. So that sort of presented to the court the case is, what's the rational reason? What's the explanation for saying this couple, which has children, should not have the same benefits of marriage? But yes, those are the plaintiffs in the Utah case, pretty similar to the other cases. The argument in all the cases is basically about the same, that under the Constitution, you have a fundamental right to marry, and to deny gays and lesbians that right denies them the equal protection of the laws.
Andrew, what's your perspective on this as a person who's also been following these cases at the state level?
I think that analysis is spot on. We are seeing people, there's another case in Michigan out of the Detroit federal court where we're seeing people, in that case, two emergency room nurses, each of whom who had adopted children who have a long-term relationship. They are co-homeowners. And their lawsuit in Detroit started as a bid simply to be able to adopt one another's children. It then got revised to include a challenge to Michigan's gay marriage ban. That went to a full trial in February. And U.S. District Judge Bernard Friedman also struck down Michigan's ban as unconstitutional, as so many other judges have been doing since last June when the Supreme Court issued its big ruling. And that case is going to be heard later this year, presumably on appeal at the U.S. Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. So that's one of three different appellate courts that are handling these cases, any one of which could go up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
If you're just joining us, we're taking a look at current same-sex marriage cases across the country. I'm joined by Andrew Harris with Bloomberg News. That's who was speaking just now. Also joining us, David Savage. He's the Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. So, Andrew, going back, you know, I think many people might forget, because so many of these cases are in the headlines, that 30 states have bans on same-sex marriage. So have you observed any trends in how these cases are going forward? Are there any broad trends that you can point us to?
Well, I think David said it well. What we're seeing largely is people, and in many instances, though not all, spurred by last year's U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the Windsor case, which struck down the Defense of Marriage Act definition of marriage as one man and one woman for federal recognition purposes, people looking at that and saying, okay, the Supreme Court said that gay couples, at least those that are in states where gay marriage is legal, have to be treated the same as heterosexual couples under the law. And people have looked at that and they've built upon that ruling to expand it across the state, even though Justice Kennedy, when he wrote his majority opinion last year, didn't go that far. He very consciously limited the ruling to states where gay marriage is already legal, but now we're seeing that spread to almost a dozen states at this point since then that have, either by legislative fiat or by judicial ruling, have since legalized same-sex marriage.
So, David, if you could pick up the thread there, what is the next frontier in terms of the recognition of same-sex marriage? I mean, many people liken it to the Loving v. Virginia case, which struck down the ban on interracial marriage. That was decided upon, as I understand it, religious freedom grounds, which is to say that the couple in question, their religious practice did not bar couples of different races from being married. And as I understood it, the ruling was that you cannot interfere with the free exercise of their religion. Is that correct or not?
No, it was basically an issue about this was racial discrimination, and there was absolutely no basis for it, no reason for it. Do you remember the Brown case was decided in 1954, and the court struck down racial segregation in the schools, but sort of stood back and didn't interfere with the laws on the books in a good number of states. I think it was more than half the states at that time, where blacks and whites could not marry. But by the time the Supreme Court finally took it up in 1967, a unanimous decision, not controversial at all. Almost no one disagreed with it. And I think a lot of the justices have wanted to sort of the debate over gay marriage to sort of go the same way, that this would, over time, the states would, you know, strike down these laws, there would be gay marriage. What's remarkable about this is it's happening so quickly. Because as Andrew said, when Justice Kennedy had that case last year, you could read that opinion, and it was not exactly clear who won and who lost on the big question of gay marriage. Because in the first part of the opinion, Kennedy said, marriage has always been a state matter. States decide on marriage. And we're talking about states that have allowed gay marriage. And the second point is the federal government can't deny equal treatment to people in benefits. And so he struck down the federal bans on equal benefits. But some people could have read that opinion and says, oh, he's going to let the states decide. But instead, every judge, as Andrew suggested, there's been something like 11 cases since then in the last year. Every judge who's seen that issue and has had to confront the question is, what's the state's justification for saying no to these gay couples. You know, what's the legitimate basis? And nobody can find one. Nobody can really explain what's the reason for denying these couples. So it's now moving very quickly.
But what's going to be the legal basis of, what is the legal basis of what these plaintiffs are seeking? Clearly, they're seeking standing within these states that don't, there are states that don't now recognize same-sex marriage. Are they seeking a federal right to marriage?
Yes, that's right. They're seeking a ruling that would say, in Virginia or elsewhere, a ruling that would say it denies their rights as citizens to the equal protection of the laws to deny marriage. And so one of those cases will get to the Supreme Court, I think, in the next term, about a year from now, if Utah or Virginia is decided. In the next term, the Supreme Court will get that case, and the question will be, under the United States Constitution, do you have an equal right to marry if you're gays and lesbians, same-sex couples?
Andrew, final question, very briefly, if you would. In the states where this matter has already been decided, has it been pretty well accepted? I mean, one of the things we recognize if we see Brown as a precedent is that even in states where, even after school desegregation was the law, there was still a lot of on-the-ground opposition. Are we seeing that?
I don't know if we're seeing it in organized protests. Human beings being human beings. I think you will always find people who are accepting of change and people who are resistant to change. And what we're seeing here is a sea change in American culture and what is perceived to be the prototypical American family. And some people will be more receptive to that than others.
Andrew Harris is legal reporter for Bloomberg News with us from Chicago. David Savage is the Supreme Court reporter for the LA Times with us in Washington, D.C. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Coming up, you might be among the millions of people who've had to fight identity theft, but you might not have thought about another target living in your house. We're talking about your kids. It turns out that children's personal information is also being stolen, and the people behind these scams might surprise you.
About 71% of child-related identity theft occurs within the family.
We'll talk more about this and what to do about it. It's our Money Coach conversation, and it's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Fresh Air, bioethicist and internist Dr. Baron Lerner talks about his new memoir, The Good Doctor. Lerner's father also was a doctor and came up in an era before advanced medical directives, when doctors often made end-of-life decisions without consulting the patient or family. The book compares the medical ethics and practices of the two generations. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages at 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. For 26 years, 10,000 Villages has been offering fairly traded gift items for family and friends, from coffee, tea, and chocolate to a collection of personal accessories and home decor.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's commencement season. You might be headed to one this weekend. And while you're probably most concerned with seeing your loved one get that piece of paper, these days many students and faculty are showing new interest in who offers those often banal but still widely noted commencement remarks. Recently, student and faculty protests pushed two prominent commencement speakers to withdraw from commencements they had been planning to address. Christine Lagarde, managing director of the International Monetary Fund, withdrew from giving the commencement address at Smith College in Massachusetts after some students there circulated a petition saying they felt that her presence would imply endorsement of the policies of the IMF. That came after former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice withdrew from plans to deliver Rutgers University's commencement address after objections were raised there. Here's one student speaking at a campus protest against Secretary Rice.
When you think of a commencement speaker, you think of someone who you can look up to. This woman has committed so many crimes that, you know, she has not even been put to trial. So how can we look up to someone who is responsible for the deaths of so many?
We wanted to talk more about this, and we were particularly interested in what these two incidents have to say, or whether they have anything to say about the nature of activism on campuses today, and whether this is a sign of healthy debate or an intolerance of it. So we've invited two college student leaders. Donald Coughlin is chairman of Rutgers College Republicans and the New Jersey College Republicans. That group protested the protests against former Secretary Rice. Andrew Souders is the legislative director of the College Democrats at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Welcome to both of you. Thank you both for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so Donald Coughlin, let me start with you. I understand that you were very disappointed that Dr. Rice withdrew as your commencement speaker. First, could you just briefly tell us, I know you're not speaking for the group, but what we heard a little bit of their reasoning, and what's yours?
We were very disappointed that Condoleezza Rice will not be the commencement speaker, and we started talking about it more on Monday because the reality was that a lot of people became afraid to voice their opinions because professors were sending out emails encouraging students to protest Condoleezza Rice, and the student protesters damaged university property and committed vandalism in some of the classroom buildings.
So she said that she did not want to disrupt the celebratory nature of the day and then become a distraction. Do you think that she made a good decision or not?
We would have liked to see her, though we do respect her decision. We think that she would have been welcomed by almost everyone in attendance, but the reality is it would have been a little bit more heated than it, you know, will be otherwise with a different speaker.
So tell me, Donald, this was one issue that grabbed students' attention. Is this overall the kind of thing that the students tend to get interested in? And you think it was her as her particular profile and her biography that attracted this? Or generally, would you say your students are interested in these kinds of issues? Or what kinds of issues tend to engage them?
Students are interested in issues that directly affect them. This was an issue that affected every senior at our school, as well as many other students, because they attend the graduation to see their friends graduate. And she's a very high-profile figure with a lot of people who are very inspired by her, and then a small group who was not inspired by her and protested her. And because it had a direct impact on everyone at the graduation, that's what brought a lot of people on both sides of the issue to voice their opinions.
So, Andrew, Greensboro has a strong civil rights legacy. It's known for the lunch counter sit-ins, for example. What are the kinds of things that the students there tend to be engaged by?
Well, our students are increasingly engaged in state issues. We're constantly engaged in campus issues, especially in terms of the budget and how our tuition money is allocated. But with the recent Republican takeover of the state, Governor Pat McCrory, and the Republican sweep of 2010, we've become much more engaged in state issues in terms of Medicare expansion, LGBT rights. We had Amendment 1 a couple years ago. They got a lot of attention. So mostly issues that really affect us and affect our friends and people that we can relate to in our personal lives.
Does that legacy of Greensboro's activism, is that something that the students there care about? Does it matter to them?
Many it does. Many, you know, it doesn't. Some may not know the history of the city. But for the ones that it does, you can really feel that spirit through the campus and through the city. And it really does have a dominating theme over the campus.
Well, what tends to get people going? I mean, obviously, social media is one way that people get organized these days. Andrew, how does it tend to work?
Well, it is funny, with more communications and social media, it's actually tending to be harder to reach people and get them motivated.
Really? How
just because? Well, I think there's so many different things that divide people's attention. Much like they talk about with cable television and being so many options. So it tends to be difficult to get people interested. Plus, you have a lot of students who are working 2, 3, 4 jobs trying to just make ends meet and stay in school. But social media does help get in touch with people and get them motivated. Word of mouth really works. It really mostly there's a snowball effect on issues that we care about.
Donald, what about you? What tends to get people motivated? And it's interesting to note that both of your organizations are relatively small. Andrew, your organization only has about 15 core members. And Donald's, your organization has about 20, you know, core members. But so, Donald, do you agree with Andrew that it's kind of, it actually, even despite all the social media, it's kind of hard to get people involved in something, to organize around something?
Students are very busy at college. They take classes, a lot of people work, and a lot of people are members of multiple organizations. So they have some free time, and they need to decide how to spend it. Our group, we've taken several initiatives this past year in terms of, instead of just doing, you know, events where it's politics is the only discussion, we do social events also, where we go out and get dinner. Everyone will go out on weekends together or go see movies. And those initiatives keep people in because they form friendships within the group so that that becomes a friend group rather than just going to a meeting a week and talking about politics. And that's been the best way. And social media gets people's attentions. But once we get them in person, we need to make sure they stay a member of our organization.
Why do you think this Condoleezza Rice issue took hold? I mean, you seem to be suggesting that there was a lot of faculty objection as well. It is your belief that the majority of the people attending would have welcomed her and wanted to hear her. But why do you think it got to a level of visibility where she felt that she had to withdraw because she didn't want to be a distraction?
Thoughts? The faculty passed a resolution in the end of February at New Brunswick to disinvite her. And from that, it kind of the students who were against her then felt motivated to not have her come speak. In the weeks in between, the student government actually had a debate over whether or not she would come, and they're the voice of students on campus who represent us, and they voted to warmly welcome her. But the faculty kept talking about nonstop how they didn't want her to come. One person actually went on Russia state-sponsored television and said how they didn't want her to come. And the faculty just kept talking about it so much that it didn't go away as an issue.
Was the fee part of it? I understand a fee was to be paid. Was that part of it?
The people who were protesting her raised that as an issue, but the reality is that that's a very standard practice for speakers. And before, Rutgers actually paid over $30,000 to have Snooki from the Jersey Shore come speak, and the same faculty didn't raise any issues about that, but all of a sudden it was a conservative woman, and they raised a lot of issues about it.
You know, I was going to ask you about that, speaking of reality. That so she was paid to speak. She was not the commencement speaker, though, and you're saying there were not protests about that.
From the faculty, there was no protest, and she was paid almost the exact same fee. And the message that she delivered was study hard, but party harder, which is not a message that college students should be getting from their tuition money.
Did you protest that?
I was not a student. I was still in high school trying to decide where to go to college at the time. And I think it made my parents hesitate a little bit, but I chose Rutgers in the end anyway.
Okay. Well, good luck with all your future plans. Andrew, final thought from you?
Well, I think there probably wasn't a dissent because she was a conservative woman. But I think when you have something so controversial as the Iraq War and there not be much of an investigation, I think that's going to lend itself towards a mob veto.
Okay.
So it's unfortunate that they didn't hear her inspiring speech, but I can understand the dissent, certainly.
Andrew Souders is the legislative director of the University of North Carolina at Greensboro College Democrats, with us from NPR member station WFDD in Winston-Salem. Daniel Coughlin is chairman of Rutgers College Republicans and the New Jersey College Republicans. He was with us from New Brunswick. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'd like to turn now to personal finance. We've been hearing a lot about identity theft in recent years. Law enforcement says it's one of the fastest growing crimes, and it can have serious repercussions. Victims of identity theft have often been denied credit they deserve and even jobs, not to mention the hours of time spent writing letters and making telephone calls to clean up the mess. Here's another wrinkle. Children can also be the targets of identity thieves. According to the Federal Trade Commission, people 19 years and younger made up about 6% of the identity theft complaints last year. Sometimes these children are victimized for years before the crime is discovered. We wanted to know how this can happen and how to prevent it and resolve it. So we've called Adam Levin. He is chairman and founder of Identity Theft 911. That's one of a number of companies that have been founded to prevent and resolve identity theft issues. He's also the former director of the New Jersey Division of Consumer Affairs. And so he's dealt with this issue. So thank you, Mr. Levin. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
So people might have heard that 6% number and say that doesn't sound like a big deal. So what's the cause for alarm?
Well, the cause for alarm is that 6% is the number you hear, but it's all about the number that you don't hear. And when about 71% of child-related identity theft occurs within the family, and this is based on a study conducted by the Identity Theft Assistance Center a couple of years ago, because it's not reported, you really don't know how large the problem really is. Because the problem is nobody wants to rat out a member of their family.
What are people using these children's identities for?
Pretty much everything. Opening credit cards, getting mortgages, keeping utilities on, getting medical treatment, in some cases committing a crime.
So when we say it's stolen, this is in fact family members who are stealing or misappropriating the child's identity without the permission of the caregiver or guardian.
That's correct. And in many cases, it is the caregiver or the guardian that's responsible for the theft.
How would one go about discovering this? I mean, I take it that part of the problem here is that often or sometimes the theft is not discovered until years later when the child tries to create a credit profile of his or her own, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So what do you do?
Well, it's a terrifying moment when you suddenly realize that your credit's been destroyed, especially by most likely somebody in your own family. You've got to file a police report, and this is where you've run into a lot of problems in terms of reporting of child identity theft, is because of a lot of children and siblings don't wish to report the theft. It goes nowhere unless you can figure out a way to convince the person who did steal your identity to step up and take care of the debt, which most of them have absolutely no desire to do. So you've got to file a police report. That's the first step. Then you've got to talk to the fraud department of at least one of the credit reporting agencies, and then you'll get a fraud alert on your file. You've got to communicate with creditors. You've got to communicate with government agencies. It's a long, drawn-out process.
I'm kind of wondering, like, what would be the family circumstances that would allow somebody to have access to this kind of sensitive information, number one, and then where somebody would victimize a child? Or you think people just aren't thinking about the long-term consequences? They just don't care in the moment?
I think in many cases they don't care in the moment. In many cases they think it's not a big deal because they'll take care of it, and by the time the child gets old enough, they'll make sure the child's credit report looks solid. Or you have some people who start with one member of the family and simply run through the entire family. It's like a shark tasting blood. And I think this is one very important concept we have to disabuse ourselves of. You can't prevent identity theft. So therefore, where you need to focus on it is, how do you monitor a situation as quickly as possible to determine your victim of identity theft, and then what kind of damage control program that you put in place?
So do you recommend that now that the government makes credit reports available for free annually, do you recommend that part of your annual financial health checkup is to check your child's credit report as well? Is that
absolutely. The only problem is if a child's below the age of 13, you really won't be able to go to annualcreditreport.com and find anything. So what happens is that most parents can now, at the moment, they can go to the three individual credit reporting agencies. They have to present their child's name, date of birth, address, birth certificate, and social security number, and then they would have to provide evidence that they are, in fact, the parent or guardian, as well as a utility bill. And then the bureau will take a look. Now, one of the bureaus will create a file and then suppress it to avoid there being a problem. The other two reporting agencies take the position they have to actually be presented with an identity theft. Then they will go in, correct the file, and then suppress the file until the child is age 18.
Before we let you go, I understand that foster kids might be particularly vulnerable because their personal information is passed around. If you are a child who has been in that situation, you've been in foster care, you're about to have control of your own affairs, is there something that you recommend that people do as kind of a first step?
Well, first of all, you're right. They are very much at risk. 10% of all foster children become victims of child identity theft. And there is a law that was passed a couple of years ago that requires now that before a child ages out, whatever the agency is that has supervisory authority over them has to run a credit report. And if they find something that is amiss, they have to make sure it's corrected before the child ages out.
And finally, this leads into a conversation we're going to have later in the program about social media and kids. A lot of people like posting pictures of their kids on social media these days. You know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I wonder whether this plays a role in this by making pictures of kids more easy to acquire, particularly with their names and their ages and other identifying characteristics. Thoughts about that?
Oh, I totally agree that there is a very serious problem that people have an unquenchable thirst to spew every possible piece of personal identifying information about their children all over the internet, and that I caution parents, don't post every picture that you possibly have. Be careful about the geotagging that's with the picture that identifies when it was taken and where it was taken. Don't talk about your child's pet or favorite color or favorite music, because all of these ultimately become answers to security questions somewhere down the road. Parents have to have an adult moment when it comes to this, and they should not be posting all of that information online. They are endangering their children.
Adam Levin is the chairman and founder of Identity Theft 911. He's also the former director of the New Jersey Division of Consumer Affairs, but he was kind enough to join us from our studios in New York City. Adam Levin, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, so there's a picture of your 13-year-old daughter lying on a bed with an older family friend with his shirt off, and it's on Instagram. That's what happened with tween star Willow Smith, but what would you do? We'll ask our panel of parents where they draw the lines for their daughters and sons when it comes to friends, relationships, and social media. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from John and Catherine Debs in support of NPR's new global headquarters and production center in Washington, D.C. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
This October, come aboard WILL's American History Train. We'll travel in private rail cars restored to their 1950s glory. Our private chef will serve delicious onboard meals as we travel to Boston, Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia for stops at historic sites, museums, and battlefields on this 10-day trip. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
What kind of beauty do you like? Is it the pampered Mediterranean coast of Monaco?
And just stand there and look at all those boats, cars, and beautiful people everywhere.
Or would you rather go wild in the fjords of Norway?
And you just completely are in awe of how stunning the landscape is in the fjords.
Explore fjord country and Monaco on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday at noon on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Today, we want to talk about setting boundaries for teens. This after 13-year-old performer Willow Smith, who, of course, is the daughter of megastars Will and Jada Pinkett Smith, made headlines because of a photo of her lying on a bed with an older shirtless male friend. And this photo was posted on Instagram. The picture went viral, and so did the debate. Some fans called the situation inappropriate or even creepy, but her mom, actress Jada Pinkett Smith, says there's nothing wrong with the picture or with what was going on. Still, the story raised a lot of questions about how parents draw the line when it comes to teenagers' friends, their relationships, and social media. So we wanted to talk about that, and with us are Danny Tucker, fitness instructor and mom of two. Welcome back, Danny.
Hi, thank you.
Leslie Morgan Steiner is back with us. She's an author, most recently of Baby Chase and a Mom of Three. Leslie, welcome back.
Thanks, Michelle.
And Phil Lerman is author of Dadattitude, a memoir about lessons learned by being an older dad. He's also the former executive producer of America's Most Wanted. That might be some helpful, provide some helpful information here. We'll see. He's a dad of one and a stepdad of one. Welcome back to you, Phil, as well.
Good to see you.
So Jada Pinkett Smith was asked about the photo by paparazzi after this, as we said, kind of went all over the place, and this is how she responded.
There was nothing sexual about that picture or that situation. You guys are projecting your trash onto it, and you're acting like covert pedophiles, and that's not cool.
You are projecting your trash onto it. What do you have to say about that? Leslie, why don't you start?
Well, I think, you know, she makes a good point, and I have a lot of respect for her and Will Smith as parents. And it's not the photo that bothers me. The photo, in many ways, is beautiful. But come on, the age of the man and the girl in the picture.
And he's 20 years old, as we understand it. He's an actor. His name is Moises Arias. And I think a lot of people who watched, you know, kid television, Nickelodeon, Disney, et cetera, will have seen him.
But he's 20 and she's 13. And I tell you, my parenting head would explode if my 15-year-old daughter or my 12-year-old daughter were found in a bed anywhere, anytime, with a shirtless 20-year-old man. And if I discovered my 17-year-old son in bed with a girl 6 years younger, I would be beyond furious.
I have to say, they weren't in bed. They were lying. They were sort of, he was sitting and she was stretched out.
They were on a bed.
They were on a bed. I just want to be clear on that. So you said your head would explode.
Yes, and I would be furious at my kids. It has nothing to do with whether they posted the picture on Instagram or not. If I discovered that my kids had done this, I would be really, really angry with them and disappointed, and I'd have a very serious conversation with them about the perils of being attracted either to a significantly older man or, in the case of my son, to pursuing a significantly younger girl. I'm no prude. I'm very open with my kids about sexuality, and they're really mature at ages 17, 15, and 12. But still, it's my job as a parent to offer boundaries and consequences. And in this case, I would definitely do that.
Danny, where are you on this? You have both an older son and a young teen daughter. Your son's out of the house, is in the Navy, but where are you on this?
Well, it wouldn't be my kids, but on this picture, though, to me, Willow hasn't been 13 ever. She was born 30 years old, the way her parents treat her. That's the way I look at it, because she's always, her and her brother have always been raised to me, you know, an adult, like adults. I mean, to me, the kids have never been kids, so I wasn't surprised by the picture at all. But I agree with Leslie on some extent, you know, that it's not appropriate. My daughter wouldn't be laying where she was laying with a 20-year-old man. But at the same time, I'm not going to say that, you know, what I saw is I don't have a problem with it. Let's put it that way.
Because why not? Tell me. Because you're saying this would not be in your house, but
right.
The picture itself, the circumstance itself. Why? Because they're actors, and actors sometimes do things that, you know, other people don't do as part of their job. I mean, sometimes they're in a state of undress that the rest of us would not be in as part of their job. Is that part of it, or what is it?
That's part of it. I mean, it also, too, it's just part of the parenting. I mean, we know Will and Jada to be free-willing parents. I mean, those kids have been grown. If you listen to them, they don't talk like your average teens. And what I'm saying is there are some open parents. I mean, there are parents who give their kids alcohol to drink before the legal age. I mean, you know, I just know that there are people who parent their children a lot more, I would say, not as conservative as many of us do. How about that? So with that, I just wasn't in shock. And I'm like, hey, that's how they parent their kids. I mean, if you look at the picture, everybody was comfortable. she was just comfortable, so it wasn't the first time. It definitely wasn't the first time. So, you know, I just think that when we look outside into families like that, we just have to understand that they're a lot free-minded than many of us are.
Phil, where are you on this?
Well, I think that the thing that's important to remember is that this is really not about Willow Smith. You know, Will Smith is not sitting there listening to NPR waiting to say what we think he should be doing as a father. You know, Jada, I just heard Phil Lerman. He says the photo's inappropriate, so maybe I'll have a talk with Willow when she gets home. This is not what it's not about what she did. There are a lot of adults in this story. None of them have told her she did something wrong here. And we have to remember that in her world, nobody said this is inappropriate. The question is, in my world, is it inappropriate? If I had gotten to the point when my stepdaughter was 13, where we are parsing the question of whether you are in bed with a 20-year-old man or on a bed with a 20-year-old man, then I have already lost the argument. I've already lost any ability to set the kind of boundaries that you're talking about. If you want to set boundaries for your kid, a good place to start is, remember the 20-year-old guy who used to hang around after he graduated high school with the 13-year-old girls in middle school? Were they all creepy? No, they weren't all creepy. There's a good chance nothing is going to go wrong if you're lying on a bed with a 20-year-old. My job as a parent is to make sure that I'm not setting the boundaries of I'm okay as long as there's a good chance nothing goes wrong. I have to set the boundary where there is the best chance of nothing going wrong.
So talk to me about that, because I'm glad you said that, because actually my operating principle around this is the only reason to talk about it is if it has something to do with the rest of us, because I'm not raising her. And I'm not in their house, and I have no idea. And celebrities often have very different lives than the rest of us. They sometimes have a lot more supervision than a lot of other kids do, because guess what? They can pay people to be around if they cannot be, in a way that a lot of us cannot, 24/7, thing one. And there are a lot more eyes on them in the way that sometimes is not the case for the rest of us. And then there's the opposite can be true. There are a lot of exposures that these people have that our kids don't have to a lot of things. So to me, that's the only reason to talk about it, is what can we learn from this? Is there something we should be talking about? So start, Phil, if you would, about this whole question of what should be happening. What is it that's raising or pushing your buttons here? Is it that the age gap is just too much for people to be in that intimate situation in your house?
If you're okay with your kid at 13 years old lying around on a bed with a 20-year-old guy, then God bless you and good luck to you. We have so many stories at America's Most Wanted, thousands of stories of child molesters and pedophiles, stories that started out with, it seemed like such an innocent relationship. He was just being friendly with her. He always walks around with his shirt off. I am saying nothing about Moises. I don't know the guy. I'm sure everything was fine in that situation. The question is, for my kid, do I want my kid to take that situation and say, this is a place where I feel I don't want my kid to feel comfortable in that situation. I want my kid to feel uncomfortable. And I want to teach my kid as a value that that's not a situation to put yourself in.
Exactly would you say to your child about this situation? If this is a teaching moment for you and you say, I know you've heard about this, here's what I don't like as a dad. Tell me what you would want to say to your 13-year-old.
What you have to say to your 13-year-old is that 20-year-olds don't belong in a bed, on a bed with you, and you don't belong in a bed, on a bed with them. If you don't understand what sexuality means and what it means when somebody gets turned on, then you have to have that conversation with the kid. Nobody wants to have that conversation with their daughter. No father wants to have a conversation with his daughter, what it means when a guy gets turned on. But if you don't have that conversation with your daughter, she's going to find out in a lot worse way.
Leslie?
You know, the way that I would approach my kids, my son and my daughters, with this is to talk about what it was like for me to be a 13-year-old teenage girl. And I think one of the most difficult parts for me of navigating adolescence was learning how to say no to men who were attracted to me, who I didn't want to have anything to do with. And I don't think that I'm unusual in that. It's really, really hard. And I don't care if he was 13 or 15 or 20, it's hard to say no. And that's what I would talk to my kids about that it's important to learn how to say no and to set boundaries yourself, and that I'm offering them the wisdom from my life. That's part of what I do as a parent, is to give them advice on tricky situations
this. Tell me exactly what you're finding tricky about this and exactly what it is that you would want to raise with your kids. And the reason I'm saying that is that a lot of people don't know what they should be upset about these days. I mean, you have very young girls who are fashion models, for example, kids who are very, very young, who are all dressed up as adults, and people look at that and they think, wow, that's really cool. I mean, I'd kind of like to do that and stuff like that. So tell me exactly, what did you say? Is it the shirtlessness? Is it, I don't want somebody with who's that much older than you in your room?
It's,
is it what?
Yeah. It's not the shirtlessness. It's that I think that there is a huge difference between a 20-year-old and a 13-year-old. And I don't care what the gender is of each. It's just 20-year-old is almost an adult, and they've had a lot of life experience that no 13-year-old, not even somebody like Willow Smith, has had. And that's what I would say to my kids, that it's just – and I would try to stay away from judgmental words like it's not appropriate or, you know, to put any label on, just that it could be very uncomfortable. You could be inviting sexual attention that is overwhelming for you or for the other person, and that – I think I would probably just – my default would be not in my house if I couldn't articulate it.
Oh, that's not judgmental at all. Oh, no judgment there. Not in my house. If you're just joining us, it's our parenting panel. We're talking about drawing the lines in teen friendships and relationships. We're speaking with Leslie Morgensteiner, Phil Ehrman, and Danny Tucker. Danny, what about you? Have you had any conversations around this at your house? What would you say? Or do you think it's something that you would want to talk about?
I mean, well, Imani's seen the picture, and she's like, no big deal. I mean, you know, I wouldn't do it, you know. And I say to that, I'm grateful because, you know, at that age, where she is, late teenager, I'm proud that the wisdom is there. You understand what I mean? Because it was a judgment call. Because, of course, I asked her about it, and she's like, Mom, they're just watching TV. I mean, why is everybody making a big deal out of it? And sometimes it becomes that. I mean, because, like you said, it's not appropriate, okay, if it's not right. You know, that's what I'm saying. Meaning, me just looking at that picture and not knowing the situation, I would say that's inappropriate. But again, like Imani and I was discussing, I don't know their relationship. This kid, you know what I'm saying? Like I said, looking at the picture, I didn't think it was the first time that they have leisured around as friends. You know? And at his age and her age, I mean, again, he's 20, she's 13, but the way that these guys are being raised is like they've been 21, you know, the whole time, and that's the life that they live. And I was proud of my daughter for assessing that, because she's like, I'm not surprised, Mom. I mean, Will and Jada are grown. You know, that's the way they, I mean, not Will and Jada, but Willow and the little one.
And Jada. Yeah. Sure, let me ask about the social media aspect of it, because that is something that all kids are involved in these days. I mean, that's just a fact. So, Phil, what about the whole Instagram aspect of it? How would you handle that part of it? I mean, kids, well, really son, young kids these days are involved with social media. You know,
my son, when he was little, he wanted a cell phone, and I told him, yeah, when you're 12, you'll get one. Whoever knew that that day would come? He just turned 12. He just got a cell phone. The week before, I downloaded one of those contracts online, and I made him. And it turns out that the week before your kid gets a phone, you can get him to agree to anything. So I got him, I get to look at your Instagram. Oh, yes, of course. I get to know all your passwords. Well, that's only for my own safety. I mean, he was giving me the whole farm because he wanted the phone. So we had this agreement, and he knows going in now that I can pick up. And I have a couple times said, okay, let me see. What are you posting? Okay, that looks okay. Okay, let me see your emails, who you're talking to. Oh, isn't that nice? All right. And it's already in his mind that that's how he relates to the world, with his father looking over his shoulder.
How often do you check his account? Every week? Every couple of weeks?
What you know, he's only had the phone for a couple of weeks, and I think I've checked it twice now. And more importantly, I think since he knows I can check at any time, he's going to go into it not wanting to put stuff up there. But more importantly for me, we always used to talk at America's Most Wanted as about how you have to teach safety as a value. You want your kids to be nice to other people. You didn't sit them down when they're seven and say, be nice to other people. Okay, got that done. Check that off the list. It's something you do every week. You go to church every Sunday. You go to synagogue every Saturday. Every time you see somebody being a jerk, you say, don't be a jerk like that guy. And don't use the word jerk. And so it's an ongoing process. And the same thing with safety. Safety is an ongoing process. You teach it as a value. And a photo like this, who knows what was going on with his kids, whether it's fine or not. A photo like this gives you a chance to once again have that conversation with your kid about what's appropriate in your house for them to post.
Leslie, what about you?
And I think it's much harder to talk to kids about sexuality, even than safety or appropriate use of technology. And what I would try to say to my kids is that somebody, when you're 13, somebody who is 6 years older than you has a huge advantage over you in every way, and psychologically, in terms of their life experience, and that if they are interested in you sexually, it's not for a good reason. And that you should never be in a relationship with somebody who has so much more power over you. And that harkens back to my own experience with domestic violence and the fact that my first marriage was a violent one. And I talk to my kids about that all the time, even though that's another uncomfortable subject. And so I'm with Phil on this, that this is a conversation that you have to have with your kids over and over again. And you know, this isn't about Willow Smith. It is about our own kids. And it's a great excuse to talk to our kids about the issues involved in being in a bed, on a bed, with somebody of a significantly different age to you.
Hey, Danny, can I ask you, since I think you've got the older son here, who's, as I see, he's a grown man now, but what about conversations that you might have had with him about this?
Oh, it's real simple. You know, bring him home too young and I'll break your neck. You know, I mean, we don't, you know, there's no need to sit down and have the, you know,
no, I mean,
we don't have that long conversation. It's just, you know, don't do it. Period. End of discussion or you die. Real simple. You know, but I'm not worried about that with him, because one thing, too, I agree with my our fellow parents, that if you have an open dialogue with your kids, this won't be new. You know what I mean? I mean, this is not, if seeing this picture is the first time you had the conversation, then you need to work on that. You know, in other words, we have always had an open dialogue, and they know what is appropriate and what's not. You know, if she's younger than you, you shouldn't be there, because she's not mentally ready to handle you. You're not mentally ready to handle her. So this is conversations we have had. But fortunately for me, they're boyfriends. They both have, you know,
significant others,
I should say. Yeah, yes. I don't know what to call them no more. They both have boyfriends and girlfriends, let's say that. And I love them both. They both. Because one thing about it, too, if you start this dialogue with your kids younger and you develop your kids, especially mentally, they will attract like-minded people. And I am happy to say that my kids have attracted like-minded people who are on the same page that they are, as well as the parents. You know, I have a great relationship with the parents as well. So I really don't worry about them going there. The two young thing, especially Davon, who will be 21, my God, next month.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. But because I know I've raised a God-fearing, respectful young man.
All right. Well, you know what we say, trust but verify. All right. That was Dani Tucker. She's a fitness instructor and mom of two. We reached her at her office here in Washington, D.C., in our studios here with me, Phil Lerman, the author of Dadattitude, A Dad of One, A Stepdad of One, Leslie Morgan Steiner, author, mom of three, and regular contributor to our Parenting Roundtables. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. You're also listening to Willow Smith now. Let's talk more tomorrow.